Hi, everybody, and welcome again to F This Movie, the podcast that proves there is no Santa Claus. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I am joined tonight by the King of the Floods, Eric Esperschlager. How are you, sir?
Help, help, I'm stuck in a chimney.
Oh.
It's funny because...
It's sad, but it's funny. But it's funny because it's sad.
Oh, but it's so sad.
Should I have said the podcast that proves there's no Lincoln's birthday?
You could say both because we're doing both movies.
So. That's right. So Eric Esperschlager is joining us tonight, and blah, 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 you're listening to F This Movie, which you can find at fthismovie.blogspot.com, twitter.com/fthismovie, facebook.com/fthismovie, dvdverdictpresents.com. Thank you to Michael Staley and Melissa Hansen and everybody at DVD Verdict. For hosting our show there. And you can always email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Which reminds me, there's an email I wanted to pull up while we talk about our movies, but I will do that while we speak.
That's right. By the way, you reminded me.
Yeah.
There's an email that you're supposed to read when we do this podcast.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Okay. Just
will do.
You asked me to remind you that a long time ago.
And thank you.
Reminded me to remind you.
Thank you so much. Hey, Eric, have you seen anything good lately?
I've seen – this is all – ever since Netflix Instant has entered my life and the ability to have the time to like watch a bunch of stuff that I might not otherwise, I've gone back to either movies that I've seen but haven't seen in a long time or movies that I should have seen but never got around to.
Okay.
And part of this was I'm talking about two things quickly. First off, today for the very first time ever, I saw Big Trouble in Little China.
For the first time?
I've never seen it before. It's the first time I've ever seen it before.
And what were your thoughts on Big Trouble in Little China?
It is not as good as the Big Trouble in Little China that existed in my mind.
Okay.
I think I expected sort of a Spielbergian madcap Goonies-esque adventure.
Yeah.
And it's not that at all.
It is a movie that is beloved by a cult of people. And there are things that I like about it a lot, particularly Kurt Russell's performance, which I think is very funny. But I will admit that while I like it, I have never seen the movie that others have described to me.
I think part of this is that I've been going through as many John Carpenter movies as are available on Netflix, mm-hmm. Instant Watch. So this very much fits in with a lot of them, especially it kind of reminded me most of like a They Live type level of both special effects and kind of general tone and content. So it is definitely a weird movie because the special effects aren't that great. And like I said, Kurt Russell's is definitely playing a character who's fun. Kim Cattrall is just shrill and kind of awful.
Yeah.
Actually, Kurt Russell sounds like he's doing kind of a John Wayne thing.
Yeah, right. Which is
a thing that right, he could probably
it's
do.
It's kind of funny.
It's funny.
It's such a bizarre – it's like it's fascinating that movie even got made. I mean, John Carpenter had some real clout in the 80s because that movie's all over the place. And I don't know who like Fox, I think, was the studio that released it. I don't know who they thought the audience for that movie would be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's. I think one of the weirdest. I think the thing that kind of set the tone for me and made me realize, okay, this is not going to be what I thought it was going to be, is that it has the John Carpenter music,
mm-hmm.
which is basically the John Carpenter "Let's Lean on the Synthesizer" thing going on. Which does. I think if it had a different, more kind of, I don't know, dramatic or upbeat, not dramatic, but kind of upbeat score, it would feel a little more interesting. Instead, it feels like, oh, this is the fog, except they're
right.
Chinese or something. It just
right.
It doesn't quite. Work, but I think it's hard to go back and watch some of this stuff for the first time, and I've generally enjoyed my trip through Carpenter land. So
do you have a favorite of the ones you've either revisited or watched for the first time lately?
I'm trying to think of what I watched now. I definitely enjoyed Assault on Precinct 13 just because it does things that you probably would not see a modern movie do,
like killing Kim Richards in the first few
absolutely
minutes. Spoilers.
Absolutely. I mean, it's so kind of brutal, and the fact that the gang members who are laying siege are just nameless, you know, die. They're just kind of they're basically zombies. I mean, it could be The Fog, or it could be kind of any other kind of horror movie,
right?
And I assume that if the movie were made today, and I know it was remade, that it would. they'd have to kind of get into the backstory of the leader and all that kind of stuff. So I appreciate its simplicity. Actually, I kind of enjoyed I mean, The Thing obviously is, you know, head and shoulders above anything else. But I even enjoyed his H.P. Lovecraft. What was it? In
the Mouth of Madness.
Mouth of Madness. Yeah, it was okay. I mean, it was not great. But as far as bringing some of the kind of Lovecraftian ideas to life, I think it did an okay job. So, you know, I think my opinion of John Carpenter's film career is probably matches up with everyone else's.
Yeah.
He's interesting, but there's definitely a dip in quality after a certain point.
I just actually rewatched In the Mouth of Madness a few weeks ago, and I hadn't seen it since probably the 90s. And I liked it a lot more than I remembered liking it. I think I could probably say now that I think that's where it ends. Like, there were a few, you know, Memoirs of an Invisible Man came before that. That's not very good. There's a few before it that aren't really great, but... I think that was his last movie that I really liked. And then it's been, well, I'm not a big Vampires fan or Ghosts of Mars. And if you have an opportunity to see his most recent movie, The Ward, I recommend you do it, but not because it's good, because it's fascinating to see, like, especially if you've been watching a lot of his movies lately, because there's just no sign of the guy that he used to be, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I watched In the Mouth of Madness around the same time I watched Prince of Darkness, is that the name of the movie?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I think I watched both of those because they were supposedly part of this thematic trilogy with The Thing.
The Apocalypse trilogy. Yeah.
And I definitely enjoyed Mouth of Madness way more than Prince of Darkness. It's a very kind of slow movie that just kind of quickly, it starts with a really interesting idea and then just becomes a, you know, zombie sort of picking people off movie. Yeah. It becomes much less interesting at that point. But, So yeah, Kurt Russell and Kim Cattrall and not great dialogue, but you know I think that if you grew up with it and the cheese factor definitely is redeeming in some ways. Although probably the least interesting Chinatown related movie that we'll talk about tonight.
anything else besides Big Trouble in Little China?
Also, in the guys in the category of not living up to my memories. I watched Flatliners again for the first time in forever. I mean, it's one of those movies. I know that maybe it was on Friday Filibuster. I talked about watching The Blob, or maybe it was watching the Fly, and remembering seeing it when I was younger, but not really remembering the ending, and wondering if that was because my dad turned it off. I don't know, but like Flatliners, I'm sure no one turned it off, but I remember the beginning of that movie way more than basically the middle point onward. I mean, it has a really kind of interesting premise. I mean, you have these medical students who decide to push them to kind of die but then revive themselves and see what's beyond the grave and all that kind of stuff, which, you know, has kind of a spooky horror movie potential. But then it turns out that what they bring back with them, spoilers, is just their past ghosts of things that they did wrong. Although really only for a couple of them, and then for Julia Roberts' character, it's that she didn't get to say goodbye to her junkie dad or something. It's just weird. And then there's another guy who, like, nothing really ever happens. I don't know. It's a movie with a lot of really famous people in it who are probably really – well, I don't know. But Julia Roberts probably wasn't that big at the time, was she? This is probably Pretty Woman, wasn't it? Or no?
It came out – I mean, she might have made it before Pretty Woman blew her up, but it came out maybe a year after Pretty Woman.
Okay. So, yeah, you know, Kiefer Sutherland – William Baldwin, as they say in the credits, Oliver Platt.
Right? Yeah.
I'm not as good with names as you are. You're very good with names. I call everyone, you know, crewman number one and number two. but anyway, so it kind of just flat lines.
Nice. Well, look at you.
Oh, I wish I were a movie critic in 1991. if I had a time machine, I'd go back. Just for that. I wouldn't try to kill Hitler or anything. I just make just a joke.
You'd have that great Flatliners zing.
Gotta write that down for my past self. But
I haven't seen Flatliners in a long time. I liked it when I saw it, but I was probably 13 or 14. And in my memory, it still might be Joel Schumacher's best movie.
It's possible. it's one of his least Joel Schumacher-y movies.
Yeah, maybe that's it.
I mean, I guess it has such potential. I mean, you have the potential to see, you know, a filmmaker's vision of what's beyond the grave. You have the chance to see kind of spooky stuff happen. And even, you know, what they see when they die is kind of boring. It's you know,
just, it's flashbacks.
Frame shots over fields and flashbacks. And, you know, yeah. I mean, say what you will about, you know, what dreams may come, but at least that was an interesting version of the afterlife.
It's got that problem. Did you ever see Contact?
Yes, a long time ago.
It spends the whole movie building up this trip to outer space, and it's like, oh my gosh, what's it going to look like? And then you get there, and it's like, it's a beach, and she talks to her dad. Boring, that's a cheat. That's kind of the Flatliners problem as well.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I've seen other things that were good, but those, I don't want to, such a downer note to start with Flatliners and Big Trouble in Little China, but even though it seems like that would be a home run.
Well, let me talk about two movies.
Save the day.
I almost downright loathed because I don't have anything good to say about these two movies.
Man, we better really be building up to Gremlins.
I watched two movies on Netflix Instant. The first is a documentary called Monster Camp from 2007. And I only bring it up because I want to sort of put a moratorium on these documentaries. It's one of these documentaries. Another one came out a couple years ago that's very similar but much better called Darkon. It's just about a group of people who live in Seattle who do this live-action role-playing, LARPers, if you will. And I want to put a moratorium on the documentary that, like, focuses on these sort of fringe, offbeat hobby, that because the movie has nothing to say about these people. It doesn't have anything to say about why they do this live action role playing. It's just sort of painstaking in terms of, like, here's how it's set up, here are the rules, here are the people involved, but it has nothing to say. And it's just one of these things that, like, is it presenting these people for us to laugh at? Does it have affection for its subjects? And in the case of Monster Camp, none of the above. It's just completely sort of standoffish. There's just King of Kong, I mean, is the movie that comes to mind. And I actually really like that movie. I think that movie does a good job of this sort of a similar subject. But I've seen way too many of these documentaries in the last few years. And I want to say no more. So don't watch Monster Camp.
Yeah. Okay. There really has to be something between, you know, the documentary that's so kind of in your face, message driven, you have your Michael Moore, Morgan Spurlock thing.
Right.
And then these movies that just, let's turn on a camera and.
Right.
We really want you to see what these people are doing. And maybe if they're doing something interesting, it's okay to just watch them and kind of draw your own conclusions. But.
Right. I mean, and I'm not opposed, right, to a documentary about live action role playing because I think there's a lot of people who may not even know what that is or what that looks like. So that's great. But you have to have sort of an attitude towards it, and I'm not saying your movie needs to be, you know, completely biased or whatever, but it has nothing to say. And then the other movie I watched, also on Netflix Instant, is from earlier this year, and it's called Ceremony, and it was directed by Max Winkler, son of the Fonz, and it stars Uma Thurman. And I'm going to get his name wrong, so I'm trying to look it up. Okay, Michael Angarano, who people might know from he was the youngest incarnation of Cameron Crowe in Almost Famous. He's the kid from Sky High. He's in Kevin Smith's Red State that's on video on demand right now. So he pops up in a lot of stuff. And the reason I bring it up, especially on this podcast, because I almost want to tell you to watch it, even though it made me so angry to watch. I really disliked the movie, but the reason that I want you in particular to see it is because it so slavishly is trying to imitate Rushmore,
mm-hmm.
Where it's sort of this young kid who might be likable, might be unlikable, sort of wise beyond his years, trying to be sophisticated, attempting to romance this older woman who wants no part of him. It tries to do all the Wes Anderson quirky, like, zooms and the soundtrack. I mean, it's so slavishly is copying Rushmore. So I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on it because I think it's interesting that you could hold the two movies up side by side and say, okay, now why does one work so well and one fail so miserably. Because I actually like Max Fisher in Rushmore, and I really hated this character. And I don't know if it's an issue of writing or performance or some combination of both.
Do you want me to tell you what I think about it right now?
Please do. Yeah, go ahead. Okay. Go ahead.
And I think it tries to do a lot of what Rushmore is. Only, I mean, because I like Max Fisher.
Sure. Okay.
And this one, you know, it does a lot of the Zooms soundtrack, and it just doesn't. Okay, I stopped listening partway through what you were saying.
I was just so happy to hear someone else that, you know, shared the same opinion as me.
I know.
I was letting you just go.
Oh, man. If only Skype had us on like a 10-second delay so I could just say everything you were going to say before you said it. It would be amazing.
Anyway, so there's two movies to watch / avoid on Netflix Instant, Monster Camp and Ceremony. Two bad movies that no one should see. But also maybe people should see them just to see why they bothered me so much.
Well, we're on our way to building up an anti-queue.
For nice. Netflix. Here's a list of movies
you
should
queue up. Create a whole separate Netflix account. So you can have a queue that's just movies that we say you shouldn't watch.
Right, right. Or only then watch if you want to be upset.
Sure. And then on those days you hate yourself that much.
All right, so let's talk about our movies, plural, for tonight. From 1984, Joe Dante's Gremlins, and the 1990 follow-up, Gremlins 2, also directed by Joe Dante. Joe Dante, obviously it wavers from day to day, but I think if someone came up to me tomorrow and said, who's your favorite director? There's a very strong chance that I would name Joe Dante. I'm a huge fan of his movies. I love all of his stuff. So if I seem overly enthusiastic about Gremlins and or Gremlins 2, this is probably why. Although rewatching the movies, I had some new thoughts, some new revelations about them. But do you want to talk a little bit about your impressions or your relationship with either Gremlins or Gremlins 2?
Sure. It's what I'm trying to – I tried very hard to think back to the first time that I saw Gremlins. And I couldn't, although I think I pinpointed my two introductions or my introduction to the movie, which I'm pretty sure was I read the novelization first.
Nice.
I'm pretty sure I got it. I think when it came out, it was 84, so I was 7. So I probably didn't go see it. But I think whenever the Scholastic Bookmobile rolled into our elementary school, I'm pretty sure I picked up the book. I definitely read it before I saw it.
Okay.
Don't remember how I saw it, when I saw it. Wasn't in the theaters, but I know I read that first. And then, anyway, really was into the ideas of what I read in that book and really loved Gremlins. So much so that whenever, must have been that same year, I got a Gremlins birthday card.
Nice.
Which not only had pictures of Gremlins on the front, but was a Gremlins birthday card because it was glued shut. Which is pretty awesome. I still remember that. I was like 8. But yeah, that's pretty great. So I definitely have a history with it, even if I can't pinpoint the time. So, and I've seen it, you know, tons of times ever since. Gremlins 2, same kind of thing. I'm not sure exactly when I saw it for the first time, but I, you know, it was one of those things that every time it ended up on TV, I would watch it. I mean, they're really great movies, especially in the way I remember them. This is the first time in a long time that I'd watched them. I don't know the last time I'd seen either of these movies before watching it for the podcast. Although I will point out as a preemptive apology, I watched both these movies about two or 3 weeks ago now, because we kept kind of having to reschedule this. So if I can't remember plot points or character names or even the names of the movies, you'll know why. So, but anyway, I
so if you get confused and think it's okay to feed them after midnight, I will step in and say, no, no, no. That's what turns them into gremlins.
Oh, okay. So
yeah.
That was not clear.
I did not see the first Gremlins in the theater either, because I was, I believe, the same age. Although I just found out today that the original Gremlins came out the same day as Ghostbusters. 1984, wow. An embarrassment of riches. At the movies, that Ghostbusters and Gremlins, two modern-day classics, came out the same day. Gremlins 2 I actually saw in theaters a couple times because it played at the second-run theater down the street from my house, and at that age, I was probably 12 or 13. anything that wasn't rated R, I could walk to and go see. And Gremlins 2, I saw a bunch of times, A, because I was surprised at how much I liked it, and B, because I kept wanting to see the audience reaction during that section where the film breaks.
Yep.
Because it worked every time. Every time you'd get people turning their heads and looking up at the booth to see what happened, and then, haha, joke's on us. It's just Gremlins.
Yeah, a little different on the DVD, but... I mean, it doesn't work as well on the DVD. It's the exact same thing.
Well, you know, when it came out on VHS, I rented it, and it was actually different on the VHS. They didn't do the whole Hulk Hogan sequence. It was like, it went to static, and then it turned into a cowboy movie, and then the Gremlins were cut in, which I think is on the DVD as like a deleted scene. But that was interesting, too, that it was one of the first times where I saw, like, oh, they changed this for the VHS release.
We'll get to the brilliance of Gremlins 2 in just a bit. Get ahead of ourselves.
Gremlins is one of those movies, though, that's sort of like in the pantheon, especially of people our age, because we grew up with it and it was on TV all the time. And it was just one of those movies that everybody saw because, you know, Spielberg's name was attached, or because it was sort of, it was in the era of sort of the Amblin movie. And Gremlins, actually, here's a bit of trivia for you. Gremlins, the first Amblin movie ever, the first movie released under the Amblin label. And so it was, you know, it was like those were the family movies of the day, which is fascinating because now you watch Gremlins and you find out, you know, it's sort of one of the movies that's responsible for the creation of the PG-13 rating. And there are things in that movie that, you know, kids maybe shouldn't see. I don't know. I mean, things have changed so much now, because back in the day, I think kids' movies had scarier stuff in them. And I kind of like that. You know, I kind of miss that now, because kids' movies are, you know, I'm happy for my son's sake, but kids' movies now are sort of watered down. Not that Gremlins is, you know, strictly a kids' movie, but it was certainly marketed to kids with all the toys everywhere and the Gremlins birthday cards that were glued shut.
Right, absolutely. I mean, that's why I got involved. I thought it was age appropriate in some way. It was also another little bit of trivia. This was apparently the first movie to go back to the old Warner Brothers logo.
Yeah.
Which is part of a kind of a general theme of both movies, in that they both have a great affection for older movies, not just monster movies, but movies in general. I mean, obviously, Gremlins 2 has a lot of references to other movies, but even the first one, a lot of the locations, obviously, where they shot on the lot, you can listen to the commentary. They even, you know, this is the same square as Back to the Future, and I think part of it was the same set that was used in It's a Wonderful Life, and so a lot of that kind of stuff too.
And it was shot at the same time as Streets of Fire, which they mentioned on the commentary, which is another totally awesome movie from 1984. That's one of the things that I've always liked about Joe Dante movies, is that they do have so much affection for past movies without ever just becoming like spot the reference or sort of this Family Guy mentality that sort of pervades our pop culture now, which is just references without any context. It's just see if you can spot, you know, the Shrek movies kind of do it. It's just like it's a series of empty pop culture references, and Joe Dante's movies always manage to incorporate all of those references in a way where, like, even Gremlins obviously takes place, you know, basically in the same universe as It's a Wonderful Life, like you said, but then obviously turns it on its head by introducing Gremlins, basically.
I mean, I guess having someone like Joe Dante do a kids movie is kind of like having a band like They Might Be Giants do kids albums. Is you take someone who is inherently talented and you ask them to do something that's is geared toward a younger audience, you're probably going to get something that doesn't talk down to them.
Right.
And you get so much talking down to kids now in movies. You know, obviously the whole licensed movie phenomenon. Just to, like you said, empty pop culture references. It's just lazy. And Gremlins is not a lazy movie. Neither of these are lazy movies.
No, in fact, Gremlins 2, I would argue, has perhaps the other problem, but we'll get to that. Again, you know, a lot of this comes from listening to the commentary or just reading a lot about Joe Dante. But if you listen to the commentary track for Gremlins, they talk about the fact that Chris Columbus wrote the script. And it wasn't really a horror comedy. It was more of sort of a straightforward horror movie, to the extent that, I guess, spoilers for things that don't happen in Gremlins. Billy Peltzer's mom, who survives in the film, I guess that's a spoiler, in sort of the movie's most famous scene where she's attacked by gremlins in the kitchen and puts one in a blender and one in the microwave. And that was sort of that's sort of the most controversial scene. And again, part of the impetus, along with Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, for the creation of the PG-13 rating. But originally in that sequence, she's killed. Billy comes home and the gremlins throw his mother's severed head down the stairs. They eat the family dog, and Gizmo originally.
The most shocking thing that they could have done.
That in the original script, Gizmo was the Mogwai that becomes Stripe. And it wasn't until, I guess, shortly before they started shooting that Steven Spielberg said, and Spielberg was kind of the guy who found the script and toned down a lot of that violence, but also who said, Gizmo's cute. I think people will like him. We should keep him in the movie. You know, he should stay a Mogwai and sort of survive throughout the movie. And I just feel like what a different movie it would be. I could do without the other changes. I don't need Billy's mom to die. I don't need the family dog to be eaten, but I feel like Gizmo turning into Stripe is much more in tune with Joe Dante as a filmmaker. Whereas keeping, you know, Gizmo, this cute, fuzzy little thing, is much more Spielbergian. I almost would have rather seen that version. I would have rather seen Joe Dante do the version where Gizmo becomes this nasty thing. Because that's so much of what the movie is about, that, you know, this cutesy, sort of kitschy Americana turning nasty and mean.
It's an interesting relationship, obviously, between Spielberg and this movie, because of what it ended up not being, or what it ended up kind of half being. Watching it again for the first time in a long time, I'm torn in some ways, because I sort of want it to go further than it does. And I really would be interested in seeing, even though it wouldn't have been a kid's movie, the original or close to original version of this movie. Not because of the over-the-top violence, as you say, but I think it would have been interesting to see it be kind of very, you know, either really a horror movie or really a comedy. It kind of sits in this middle, kind of uneasy middle ground now, where you sort of, like I say, want it to go a little bit further, just because the potential is there. I mean, gremlins are a destructive force. They're little monsters. Do they actually? Well, I guess they technically kill Mrs. Deagle, but is there anyone else that they actually kill?
Not in the finished movie. No.
Yeah, yeah. So they're just sort of annoyances who seem like they're trying to kill people, but they kill the science teacher
too. Oh yeah, 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 right. And you think they kill Mr. Futterman until, of course,
spoilers.
Yeah, he shows up in Gremlins too, and he's fine. So
yeah, yeah. But yeah, Gremlins is a movie that is sort of best enjoyed with Wikipedia open at the same time you're watching it, because there's so many, or listening to the commentary, because there's so many details about things that happened on the production end or happened in the, you know, the script writing process, that just sort of kind of add to the overall experience of the movie. I mean, you kind of see what it's almost amazing that it became what it, you know, as good a movie as it did, with so many kind of changes being made along the way. And I mean, Spielberg definitely made it an accessible movie, and a movie that kids would enjoy, that they could market. And, you know, he has a good instinct for that kind of thing. But, you know, he also kind of seemed at times like he was, you know, a bit of a kind of school marmish and say, no, you can't do that. No, that's not quite right.
And he was one of the people that wanted the one of the other sort of famous scenes from the movie is the Phoebe Cates monologue that we referenced in the beginning about finding out that there's no Santa Claus. And Spielberg actually was not in favor of having that monologue in the movie, but at least had the good sense to leave it up to Joe Dante. And Joe Dante's feeling was that the monologue sort of captures so much of the tone of the movie, that it's horrible but funny, you know, and that's so much of what's going on in Gremlins, and it's a tricky tone to pull off, I think. And you know, it's something that would be, I think, repeated by other movies throughout the 80s, and I don't think that Gremlins always gets the credit for sort of combining some of these elements in such a way that was still, you know, commercially viable. And again, like you said, that was probably Spielberg's hand. And it's really Joe Dante's only big commercial hit.
It's funny, funny line in the commentary. He calls the movie a medley of his hit.
Yeah, right.
it's pretty funny line.
And it was very difficult to make. They had all kinds of issues with the puppets, and the budget was, you know, it was made for around $10 million, which in 1984 obviously got you a lot further. But to think of that now, I mean, this movie wouldn't be made for less than $100 million, and all the Gremlins would be CG, and, you know. And so much of that comes from, you know, Joe Dante's days working with Roger Corman. He sort of knows how to create sort of a low budget monster movie, you know, that feels like a big budget Spielberg movie. You know, people complain that the special effects don't hold up, and maybe we're just not able to distance ourselves from, you know, in 1984 or 85 when we watched it on TV, like, we didn't really question the special effects, you know, that's what right. effects looked like, and they were puppets and it was fine. We bought it. And maybe a new viewer in 2011 would have a hard time accepting the effects, but I've never had a problem with them.
No, I think it's impressive. Like you say, to see how much they did with as little as they had. And it has that sort of, you know, let's paint a barn and put on a show
right.
quality. It has that kind of DIY, you know, aesthetic, and it, like you say, it goes back to the kind of monster movie, you know, low budget monster movie roots. And it's, I think watching it again, I definitely got a sense that, oh, this isn't quite, they're not quite as menacing or as magical as I remember in my mind, but that's mm-hmm. probably a testament to how impressive they were when I was a kid, that I mm-hmm. kind of carried this idea of them. Obviously the effects got, you know, better, quote unquote, in the sequel, although there was a different group of people making the Gremlins. I guess Chris Wallace did the special effects in the first one, and he, I guess, also worked on Raiders of Lost Ark and some other movies that he talked about in the commentary that I can't remember now. But I'm not, you know, they definitely and the commentary especially makes you appreciate just how difficult it was to do as much as they did.
Yeah. I mean,
there are a combination of, you know, different effects techniques. There's even stop motion at one point. The huge kind of crowd scenes of the Gremlins and what they did to sort of fake their way through it with puppeteers that would have like three or four Gremlins, you know, some just sort of strapped to their shoulders and they weren't really moving, but they had a few others that were moving and they just kind of wiggled them in order to make it kind of work. So it is an impressive movie, whether it kind of holds up for brand new viewers or not. I think that we can agree that it was a good 80s. Oh man, I needed to stick that landing and I just didn't.
Oh. It's you know, the first one actually doesn't have that many like big group Gremlin set pieces. For the most part, they're kind of individual. There's, you know, the scene in the bar and the scene at the movie theater, and for the most part that's it in terms of the big group sequences, which you don't even necessarily realize until you watch the sequel and you see how many Gremlins are in that movie. And again, it's a weird balance of tone, especially in the first film, because I think it wants to be accessible much more so than I think the sequel is to mainstream viewers. And the Gremlins, you know, for the most part, are played for laughs. And some of that, again, just goes back to Joe Dante's sort of affection for, you know, the old Looney Tunes cartoons where it's cartoon violence. It's mm-hmm. not – nobody's really being hurt. They bonk each other on the head and they fall down. And it's sort of a spirit of anarchy, but it's not necessarily nasty, menacing violence. And then that's what makes those sequences like the kitchen assault stand out even more, because – it really is so kind of hardcore that you're not ready for that level of sort of violence and gore in a movie that is basically just playing these moments for laughs. But again, I think that the original does a better job of taking the threat seriously than the sequel does. And I mean, that's by design. The sequel is really only interested in being a comedy. It doesn't really have the same horror elements that the original film does. And maybe we should open it up to talk about the sequel a little bit. Yeah. And I want to read an email from a listener, Luis, who wrote a while ago, back in July, actually, and I've been holding on to this email. And he just says, any thoughts on situations involving studios giving full creative control to directors in order to entice them to make a sequel to a hit film they've made? And the examples he cites are Tim Burton for Batman Returns and Joe Dante with Gremlins 2. And I guess we could lead into the discussion on Gremlins 2 just by sort of, I guess, posing that question. I mean, I feel like the answer is actually sort of obvious, but what are your thoughts?
I think it works for Gremlins 2. Think that like as you were just talking there, you see just how much of a kind of an in-between movie the first one is. I mean, like you say, a lot of the violence is cartoonish, but at the same time, you see people, you know, see the Santa Claus with gremlins attached to him, and you know, you see a gremlin shoot another gremlin in the face. I mean, there's no blood. You know, and when they do finally bleed, it's just kind of green goo and they melt and stuff. So it has that cartoonish feel, but there is definitely an undercurrent of violence and death, you know, going on there. And the fact that he wasn't able to take it as far as, you know, something like The Howling, where, you know, it's very much, you know, a horror movie, kind of hamstrings the movie, not as a kid's movie, but just as an expression of what these characters are. Apparently, he was more interested in the comedy side of Gremlins, because when it came time to actually do whatever he wanted to with the sequel, he made Gremlins 2, which I could say is much more of a comedy. I appreciate that he picked one direction and stuck with it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Gremlins 2, there's no kind of half measure. There's no confusion about what kind of movie it is. I mean, there's certainly the perceived threat of what would happen if the Gremlins got out into the city, but that's not really what the movie is about. It's about how many different kinds of gremlins can we fit into this crazy futuristic building? What kind of commentary can we make on the then growing kind of cable TV culture? And mm-hmm. we could talk a bit about that and how kind of prescient that was. But mm-hmm. I mean, it's much more kind of about being an audience member and participating in just sort of, or just kind of not participating, I guess, in life by just sitting back and watching things and seeing how that goes. But
yeah, as a Joe Dante fan, I'm much more interested in his sort of no holds barred version of Gremlins 2. To go back to like Luis's question, I mean, obviously, I won't say that sequels like are bad in principle. It's just that so many of them are bad that now we're just used to saying that sequels are bad. But you know, if I like a movie and you know, I'm all for spending more time in that world with the characters that I like or whatever. So I'm not opposed to a sequel. And if you're going to give a filmmaker sort of carte blanche to do whatever he or she wants in a sequel, that's way more interesting to me than just trying to reproduce a series of elements or, you know, what was it that the audience liked or whatever. So even when I don't like the movie, take an example like Bad Boys 2, which is a terrible movie. It's like the most socially irresponsible movie ever made, but it's such like a pure distillation of who Michael Bay is as a filmmaker that I'm much more interested in seeing that than some sort of studio compiled version of Bad Boys 2. I'd much rather just have Michael Bay, gloves off, here's my horrible, hateful, misogynist, racist, homophobic movie. And Joe Dante, Gremlins 2 is Joe Dante's Bad Boys 2. I mean, this is, if you want to know who he is as a filmmaker, you just need to see Gremlins 2 from the very opening frames, where it starts with a Looney Tunes short just because he's working at Warner Brothers and loves Looney Tunes. So it's like, let's throw it in the movie. It doesn't have anything to do with anything in the movie. I mean, I guess to some extent it does, like we said, you know, it sort of sets up this idea that, you know, Gremlins 2 in particular definitely takes place in the same universe that like Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck inhabit. But, you know, starting with that, and there are so many different references to other movies and old monster movies and clips from old monster movies and a lot of the same themes that Joe Dante works with over and over again in his movies, the failure of technology, which is there in the original Gremlins, just with Billy's dad, sort of the failed inventor, but on such a massive scale in Gremlins 2 that it's this clamp tower, that a building that's automated that where nothing works. Mm-hmm. Gremlins 2 just feels like Gremlins, you know, on steroids, like times 1,000. It's just everything about the first movie. And he's talked, you know, in interviews or on the commentary track, you know, Gremlins 2 wasn't a big hit. Because, like I was saying, it didn't necessarily deliver the same things that the original movie did. So people that were fans of the original film might have gone to see the sequel, and it's, oh, this doesn't resemble that other thing that I liked. This is weird. But it's so far ahead of its time, not just, like you said, with the sort of prediction of the cable TV culture, but in that it's one of the first mainstream Hollywood movies that I can think of that's very... I don't want to use the phrase postmodern, but like it's sort of this meta commentary on sequels and on the first film. And I think now people have a much better handle on that. Thanks to stuff like Scream or whatever, where now we sort of understand what that is. But in 1990, I don't think people really got what he was trying to do at all. And maybe that accounts for some of the movie's box office failure.
Yeah, probably. I mean, I think that the best thing about Gremlins 2 is that it's not a retelling of Gremlins 1, which it could easily have been. I mean, even if they had simply, you know, set it in New York, but set the Gremlins loose in New York.
Absolutely.
Then you could have had exactly the same thing. But because they contained the threat in Clamp Tower, they were able to just kind of go nuts with the Gremlin designs and the references. And there's so much in it that it's just kind of this, it's a microcosm. It's its own little mini city anyway. It's presented as this, you know, most advanced, technologically advanced, you know, building in the world, this smart building. You know, 1990, that wasn't as, wasn't as common as an idea as it is now. I mean, now it's, you know, we talk to our, I guess I haven't really talked to our appliances yet. I'm waiting for the day where I can talk to my toaster. That's all I want
to do. I talk to my toaster every morning. It has never talked back.
I swear at my toaster occasionally. Because, yeah. You know, how is that medium? That's what basically, you know, toaster is it's light or it's dark. It's one is light, two is burnt. I don't know. Don't get me started on that. Anyway.
Here goes your toast riff.
I know. Wait, hold on. I got some notes here. Material I want to try out. No. But yeah, I think it's so impressive to see a director just do whatever he wants to do and to see him pull it off. I mean, you know, go back to Luis's original question. I mean, something like Batman Returns, I haven't seen in a long time, but I didn't like it as much as the first Batman. I think seeing Tim Burton's kind of unhindered vision, we now know, is not necessarily the best thing in the world. It's kind of right. I mean, George Lucas has complete control over his properties, and
right.
And the internet is burning right now. There are e-cars being turned in the street because of what's going on. So I mean, I think you're right in that giving a director as much control as possible and seeing what they do with it can give you something interesting, even if it's your interesting mess TM registration mark, whatever. I don't know how the patent application's going, but. I think with someone like Joe Dante, he's able to make a movie that is just super ambitious and a lot of fun to watch, and just packs so much in. I mean, and it's funny. I mean, it's not just, you know, the references and stuff, but just little things I'd forgotten about, like the fact that early on, Billy's boss takes him to a chic new Canadian restaurant. where the waiters are dressed like Mounties. I can't. And Gordon Lightfoot plays in the background. I mean, it's that. And the dessert is a chocolate mousse head. It's just. I mean, it's like that. Like, that's funny stuff. Gremlins aside, it's just a really a really great movie. And you know, like the film breaking, you know, part in the middle. I mean, right. It has the spirit of anarchy, the spirit of fun. It just takes all of the goofy Warner Brothers aspects of the Gremlins from the first one. And right, you're right. Just ramps it up, and it's a lot of fun.
It surprised me because again, it is definitely played as a comedy, and the Gremlins are never really a threat. But there are moments in the movie that I think top the original in terms of like gore. And I had forgotten that. I remembered the paper shredder scene, which is obviously him trying to sort of recreate or top the microwave scene from the original. But I forgot about Phoebe Cates in the elevator. And how messy that gets. So it's definitely, while sort of a very broad comedy, as well as I think being a very clever satire, it is kind of gory at times. Watching it again, and I've always been a big fan, and I think this is one of the few cases that people point to where they say, you know, name a sequel that's better than the original. I think a lot of people say Gremlins 2. And I could definitely see that. I'm not 100% positive that I agree, because I think they're trying to do such different things. I think the original Gremlins actually works better as a movie, as just a straightforward kind of entertaining narrative. Gremlins 2, you know, again, as a fan of so many of the things that Joe Dante wants to pay tribute to, as a fan of Joe Dante as a filmmaker, Gremlins 2 is the movie that I'll watch. Just to enjoy myself with one of his movies, because like you said, there's so much going on. It's like they sat down and just said, let's write 10,000 gags. And that's what the movie is. It's just this collection of gags, the way that an old Looney Tunes short is, even the Canadian restaurant or whatever. I love the Clamp Towers logo, which is just, you know, the earth being smashed in this clamp, you know.
Yeah, this is a great scene when the building's on fire and the voice comes on and it says something along the lines of, "Fire, man's oldest foe, giver of warmth, bringer of life. The building is now on fire. Please make your way." It's just such a great...
It's a movie that needs to be seen a few times, I think, to catch everything that's going on. But watching it this time, I honestly, for the first time ever, and maybe I'm just getting older, like at a certain point, I almost felt exhausted, or like I started to get numb to it. And I had this thought near the end of the movie, and it made me think of a story that he tells on the commentary track. Near the end, there are so many more gremlins in this movie, and there's all kinds of – there's the lightning gremlin and the vegetable gremlin and the girl gremlin and the gremlin with the voice of Tony Randall. And again, it's just all these different – what gags can we come up with? And by the end of the movie, there are so many gremlins in the movie that I really had the reaction like, oh, there's too many gremlins in this, because their cackle just started to grate at me. And it made me think of that story that he tells on the commentary where Warner Brothers, after seeing the first movie, said – we like it, but you know, there's too much with the gremlins. And Steven Spielberg's response was, well, why don't we take it out and call the movie People? And I will forever love Steven Spielberg for that answer.
That's great.
But yeah, I got a little exhausted by the movie this time. Yeah.
I go back and forth on, it's probably not even a fair question to ask, you know, which is the better movie. Mm-hmm. I go back and forth. I mean, Gremlins 2, I think, is a pure expression of an idea.
Yeah.
The first one is, like I say, just kind of this half step, this kind of almost a compromise. I think that because it establishes the world and the characters and it has, you know, more kind of threat and urgency to it, it is the better movie in that regard. Mm-hmm. But because it could have been more, I have to deduct a few 5/10 of a point.
Yeah.
But Gremlins 2 doesn't exist as a movie without the first one. No one's going to sit down and just watch Gremlins 2 and know what's going on. I mean, it is entirely a commentary on the first movie. I mean, down to the point where there's a scene where Billy's trying to describe the rules to these, you know, IT people, and they're just, you know, laughing and asking all these questions, is legitimate questions about the rules. Like, well, what happens if you, you know, get in a plane and you go across a time zone and it's midnight somewhere? And then, of course, a gremlin leaps out and rips his throat out. But maybe they just like this podcast. They need to be seen together. Maybe you can't have one gremlin's run. Why can't we all just get along? Is what I'm saying.
Nice, good.
You're just trying to tear us apart. And I'm just saying.
Yeah, Gremlins 2, I mean, it's such an ambitious movie, and it's such almost an overly busy movie at times. And there are so many touches that I love, just even having Christopher Lee involved or having Robert Prosky sort of dressed up as Grandpa Munster and hosting this old horror show. And there's so many things about it that I love. I guess the thing that I like best about the original Gremlins, and it's not necessarily a new idea, but the way that it sort of subverts the Capra-esque small town idea, and that's sort of what it has going on at its center. And Gremlins 2 doesn't necessarily have a sort of a singular cohesive idea like that at its center. Its major idea is let's just make movie anarchy, and let's comment on everything that we can comment on, whether it's sequels or the first movie or old monster movies or weird industrialization, Donald Trump, all these different ideas. So, the central idea of Gremlins 2 is sort of let's tackle everything, which I admire. And I love the movie. I will never say that I don't love Gremlins 2, but it's just I could definitely see why somebody who really likes the first movie would not have the tolerance for the sequel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I'm just at a point, maybe because I don't have the same affection for Joe Dante as you. Not that I don't like the guy. I've probably seen more Joe Dante movies than I think I have, but I'm just not aware of it. Name some Joe Dante movies and I'll see if I've seen them.
Hollywood Boulevard, I think, was like his first. Then he did the original Piranha.
Okay.
Then he did The Howling. Then he did a sequence in Twilight Zone, the movie.
Okay.
Then Gremlins. Then Inner Space. Then The Burbs. Then Gremlins 2. Then
seen that.
After Gremlins 2 was probably Matinee.
Okay.
Small Soldiers. And at that point, it really tapers off. He made Looney Tunes Back in Action and then hasn't had a wide release. He made a movie called The Hole, which has never received distribution in America. I guess if you live in Italy or England, you can buy it on DVD or Blu-ray. Never was distributed here. And otherwise has sort of been working in cable. He made a couple of Masters of Horror episodes and a made-for-HBO movie called The Second Civil War, which is very dark. But I think those are most of his major releases.
So I'd like to point out that I can see Patrick's computer monitor reflected in his glasses, and I'm pretty sure he doesn't have IMDb open.
So. No, I don't. I'm sorry. Good.
I salute you. Actually, it's interesting to you remind me the sequence in the Twilight Zone movie, which is based on the episode "It's a Good Life." My recollection of that portion of the movie is that it leads into Gremlins 2 pretty well. I mean, it's the same kind of cartoony, mm-hmm. kind of mix of cartoon and cartoonishness and violence
mm-hmm.
That basically says, yeah, this is the right person to make this movie.
Yeah, it sort of says if you apply cartoon logic to the real world, it's right. kind of it's horrifying, you know?
Absolutely.
The results are horrifying.
I mean, much like Super we talked about last time, you take comic book tropes and apply them to the real world and people get their heads smashed in. So,
right.
Yeah, I still have a lot of affection for Gremlins. I still love it. I was not as taken with it maybe this time as I had been in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I wish it had gone for a little bit more than it did. It was not as violent or as horrific as I remembered.
Mm-hmm.
I guess because I'm not 8 anymore, but and I'm jaded and I mean. Sure, I have a few hobos in the crawl space, but insulation is really expensive. So, but no, it still is a great movie. And Gizmo's just so cute. And there, yeah. and as dumb as the rules are, I love them. It's just so simple. I mean, I wish being a dad was as simple as those rules.
It's interesting. Gizmo is without a doubt sort of my least favorite part of both movies, and I get the sense that he's also you really get the sense that Joe Dante is far more interested in the Gremlins than he is in Gizmo. And that if he could do away with Gizmo, which again was in the original draft of the script, he would. And especially in the sequel, I felt like they, you know, A, the sequel has just no interest in really doing anything with Gizmo except having him watch Rambo and put a headband on. But that they really are sort of laying on the cuteness,
mm-hmm.
I think, even more sure. than the original does.
Yeah. I mean, I think that in both movies, Gizmo is kind of hurt or tortured, or there's some sort of violence, which is not, it's not just the Gremlins doing that. It's also Joe Dante and the,
mm-hmm.
and then the crew. I think in a commentary, he mentions that they had a, you know, kind of an open sheet tacked up somewhere that it was, you know, terrible things we can do to Gizmo, and people would scribble down their ideas, you know, like the awful things that they could have Gremlins do to Gizmo. You know, there's also just the fact that, really, without, if you remove Gizmo, you wouldn't have Gremlin. You wouldn't have, the Gremlins would not be a problem.
That is true.
If he did not stand, you know, if he just stayed in the filing cabinet like Billy told him to, stay in the car, Chuck. If he'd stayed there and then come out and got the water on, there wouldn't be a problem.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
For the first movie, I will lay the blame on Billy because he was a bad, you know, you don't let whichever Corey that was near your kids.
That was Corey Feldman.
Feldman, thank you.
Yeah, I
thought it was, but early, I didn't want to.
Early Corey Feldman.
Yeah, you know, because why you have an open jar, a brush jar of water? It's just it's pretty. I mean, at that time, sure, he didn't know what would happen if it got him wet, but.
But again, and I love the idea at the center of the movies, and this is something that Joe Dante deals with a lot in his movies. That, you know, try as you might to sort of control your environment or master the world around you, you know, usually through technology, especially apparent in the sequel. But obviously that's very true of the Gremlins too, that, you know, there are things in the world that you cannot control and they will turn into monsters and try and kill you.
Like children.
I like that, idea. And the more I think about the fact that in the original draft that Gizmo turned into Stripe, the more it bums me out that that's not the version that we saw, because I think that's so much more in keeping with especially what the original movie is about. But again, it wouldn't have been a hit. Maybe we never would have had the sequel, because obviously, you know, Gizmo, I think, was a huge part of what people latched onto. There were Gizmo dolls everywhere, and they make jokes about that in the sequel where he says, you know what I see? You know, suction cups on car windows. And, again, they just are constantly making jokes about the culture of Gremlins. And maybe the sequel just came out too long after the fact. Maybe 6 years later, people didn't care as much. I don't, you know, and Joe Dante has said that Warner Brothers tried for years to come up with a sequel and finally weren't able to come up with anything, so just approached him and said, do whatever you want. But I have a feeling that any other sequel that we had seen would have been exactly what you described, which is just, I'm in a new town and the Gremlins are back, you know, it's Gremlins in the yeah. city. And I just can't imagine how uninteresting that movie would be. Yeah. So I'm so glad that we got the sequel we did.
And the best we can hope for is that I do, in fact, perfect my time machine. And in addition to going back to 1991 and writing my scathing Flatliners review, I can go back even further to 1983.
Okay.
And somehow get the Chris Columbus Joe Dante version of Gremlins made. Now I'm gonna have to create an alternate timeline because we also want to have the sequel,
right?
I'm gonna need to sketch this one out.
It's gonna be tricky because now you're dealing with alternate timelines, sideways right. universes, and maybe we're all just in limbo.
Sure, and I got to make sure I stay away from this classic bookmobile because I might run into myself, and that's never good. I mean, really. I just recently watched Back to the Future 3, and I mean, one of the side effects of time travel is that it turns out that a woman who looks just like your mother was married to your great grandfather, and I don't know how that works. So I mean,
are you a fan of Back to the Future 3?
It's okay. I mean, it's fine. I mean, I think I can totally agree with, I believe, what is your central thesis, that Back to the Future is, if not the best movie ever made, then one of the best movies. I mean, it's pretty well flawless.
Yeah.
I always love Back to the Future 2. I think more than 3 just because it's more ambitious and a lot of crazy stuff happens and they go all over the place. But
yeah, my issue with 3 was always, if you want to make a Western, just make a Western. You don't have to attach the Back to the Future name to it, you know?
Right.
But whatever. Unless you're going to do a bunch of sequels where, oh, now Marty's in prehistoric times. And now, you know, I don't want that in my life. But to only do one situation where you go back to a very specific period doesn't make sense to me. But we're not talking about Back to the Future.
No, I know. I mean, frankly, I'm surprised you brought it up. But must be those gremlins.
Must be. Yeah, that music sticks
great
in your
music.
Head, doesn't it?
I mean, that and the gizmo lilting gizmo-ness, gizmo song.
Yeah, I would sing it now, but I'm not going to. And yeah, if you've ever seen Looney Tunes Back in Action?
I have not.
It's very much trying to sort of recapture, again, the Looney Tunes spirit, but it's very similar to Gremlins 2 in just like, let's try everything. And I do think, you know, that movie tanked in a bad way and Joe Dante had a horrible experience making it, but I think it's very underrated. And there's a little gag where Brendan Fraser runs out to his car, which is a gremlin, and very softly on the soundtrack in the back, just for a few seconds, you hear, dun, 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 and it's like, oh, there's Joe Dante referencing himself again. And
yeah. How come, you know, that's something they did in old movies all the time, is just have just a few notes in the soundtrack that said, this is what this is about. Like,
right.
Like if it's a movie in the hospital and the woman's having a baby, they play a little bit of a lullaby.
Right,
just, in the,
right.
just the score would just go into that. We don't have that anymore.
No.
Why don't you have that anymore?
Well, movies nowadays are much more subtle. Just
sure. I mean,
kidding.
You know, I mean, John Carpenter movies, like in the middle of a scene, they'll play stuff from other John Carpenter movies,
yeah.
You know, just to underscore the fact that you're watching a John Carpenter movie. You know, that kind of stuff. I don't know why no one does that anymore.
Let's bring it back. There's your third time machine assignment. All right.
Oh man, this is getting expensive.
You're going to be busy.
All right.
You're rewriting movie scores, but remember that the Flatliners thing, that's priority one.
That's easy. I mean, that's doable,
but you have to make sure you do that before anything else, because I'll be honest. I don't want to live in this current world where no one has written that about Flatliners.
Sure. And frankly, I'm not going to Google it to make sure that no one has.
I think,
because I imagine someone has.
I'm guessing somebody did, yeah.
But I think it would be easier because, I mean, this is the 1990s. You know, news, much like the buffalo once roamed the plains in great herds, newspapers, before they went extinct, just everywhere. Just you couldn't go down the street. Yeah. Basically, all the newspapers have turned into Starbucks now. But just as far as the eye could see, it was tribunes and journals and – and Union Gazettes, and I'm sure I could find one of them to bring that review of Flatliners.
We've gone way off the reservation here. And,
did I mention I watched these movies 3 weeks ago?
I think you did. I think you did. So I guess that's it. Everybody see Gremlins and Gremlins 2 if you haven't. And if you have, see them again and reassess them with our chilling insights. Thank you for listening, everybody. Remember, you can always email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com and give us suggestions for future shows if you would like. I'm not promising we're going to do them, but, you know, I give you the illusion of being heard, and that's what I'm all about.
Frankly, if you send it, I'll use my time machine to go back and make it happen. So send them anyway. Just send them anyway.
Thanks for being on the show, Eric.
Thank you for having me.
Any parting thoughts?
Don't feed me. Yeah.